From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms and grandmothers tuning in today, and thank you so much. Without you, we wouldn't have a single listener. The Supreme Court rules on public prayer. A major new report on online Islamophobia and the Nigerian hostage crisis. That's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio. Remember, friends, this program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air.
Many American Muslims feel they are once again in the position of having to defend their faith.
You have quite a number of famous, prominent Islamophobes.
The more they speak and the more they incite people, they themselves are a concern. It's creating a lot of hatred.
Sadly, the level of anti-Muslim sentiment in this country continues to grow. And if it's not something you observe out in public, it's certainly rampant online and in social media. The organization Muslim Advocates has just released a detailed report outlining what's happening and who's doing it, and how each of us can help fight back against religion-based bigotry and hate. On this week's show, I'll talk to Muslim Advocates Madiha Ahusain.
In a video released today, the leader of the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram, standing in front of an armored car, says, "I abducted your girls." It's been three tormenting weeks since the girls were reported missing, but since then the authorities have been unable to find them.
The kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in Nigeria has made headlines and provoked calls for intervention. As we follow this terrible story in a far-off place, we'll get some concrete ideas for action here at home from the Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson. But first,
in a pivotal 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court upheld the right of local governments to open town meetings with prayer. Writing for the majority opinion, Justice Kennedy stated, quote, "The inclusion of a brief ceremonial prayer as part of a larger exercise in civic recognition suggests that its purpose and effect are to acknowledge religious leaders and the institutions they represent, rather than to exclude or coerce non-believers."
The Supreme Court this week issued its ruling in the important Town of Greece versus Galloway case. In their first major decision on this issue of prayer at public gatherings since the 1980s, the justices ruled in favor of the upstate New York suburb of Rochester and against what many of us understand to be the cornerstone of religious liberty: participation in our government process without being required to be a part of an overtly sectarian prayer. Interfaith Alliance was a co-signer of an amicus brief in support of the respondents, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, the New York Civil Liberties Union, and the Anti-Defamation League. And I'm very pleased now to welcome Rabbi David Saperstein, director of the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism, which also filed a brief in the case. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, David.
Always an honor to be with you all.
Were you surprised?
Well, surprised is a tough word here. Very disappointed. We've seen the arc of the last 25 years of court decisions to be the slow dismantling of the wall separating church and state. And this is just another piece of that.
Yeah.
This makes three cases in which a Roberts Court has considered the Establishment Clause side of our religious protections, and in each time it has weakened the protections of separation of church and state.
Right. Well, let's start with a quick overview of the case itself. Despite the Town of Greece claiming to offer opportunities for various faiths to be represented, the track record of opening prayers at their town meetings is almost unanimously and overtly Christian. Will you comment on that?
They had done only Christian prayer until legal action was begun against them, and then they did invite some other faith traditions to offer prayers. But as I understand it, as soon as the record was closed in this case, they've only invited Christian prayers again. So that's clearly the pattern, and that differentiates it from a number of prior cases that the court had considered regarding school prayer that had more diverse prayer. Even there, the court had often struck down.
Knowing how much people respect your opinions, David, tell our listeners why this case was so important to the Religious Action Center and what your involvement was in commenting on it.
All cases that deal with the Free Exercise Clause or the Establishment Clause are important to us because you never know when the court is going to analyze the case in a way that will affect things far beyond the specific facts before the court. We have fought for a long time against school prayer, against prayer in most government settings, and this was in a new area that had not been considered by the court before, which was the local town council, the kind of legislative body in America in which people directly interact with it, come before it, present their cases. It's almost closer to a court setting than it is to, let's say, a state legislature or the United States Congress, where when they begin with ceremonial prayer, it is primarily for those people who are the elected officials, not the people coming to do business before them.
Building on that, David, how broadly do you see the applications for this ruling playing out?
No one knows. The last time that the court evaluated legislative prayer in the Marsh case 30 years ago, it did so on grounds that was different than any other test that the Supreme Court had used, which was historical precedent. It said, we've always had prayer in legislatures and the Congress, and therefore we can continue to have it. It did point out, and I believe in a footnote, that the prayer there was non-sectarian prayer and clearly marked that as one consideration for the court. Why this was different was this was clearly not non-sectarian prayer. And now that prayer has been upheld. We can expect in other government settings now to hear sectarian prayer of all kinds that are going to be deeply troubling to people who are before that legislative body, or we could have court prayer now in which people are subject to sectarian prayer who don't accept those values, and it puts them in a very awkward position. They don't want to stand up and walk out. They don't want to sit while others are standing because the very people who have kind of endorsed the prayer are the people that they've got to pitch their business to. Therefore, they're caught between being coerced by pressure to participate in the prayer or to risk adverse reaction to their not participating in the prayer.
Yeah.
So this really has wide implications. We don't know the extent of it yet, but it's deeply troubling in opening up a new chapter in which government-endorsed sectarian prayer could become a norm in American life.
Some of our listeners know that Rabbi Saperstein is also an attorney. David, do you think something was missed in the way the case was argued?
No, I actually thought that the argument was a strong argument. And the briefs, your brief, the briefs that we were involved with, I thought made very strong arguments. I think all of the factors needed to be there. As we know, the court is divided 4-4 between those who uphold the Warren and Burger Court era decisions in a number of areas dealing with fundamental rights, including areas of religion, and four who are willing to make significant changes in weakening a lot of the protections erected by the Warren and Burger Court. And Justice Kennedy, who wrote this decision, is often the swing vote. He has voted against school prayer in a number of cases, as frankly have a couple of the other judges on the more conservative side. But with adults, the court has always been a little more lax, and Justice Kennedy wrote a decision in which she agreed it would be allowed. I don't think it was because anything was missed in the argument. And even Kennedy himself shows that he's troubled by the Pandora's box that might be open. He said at one point in the case, you know, this would be a different case if the prayer was demeaning to non-believers or minority religions, threatening damnation, encouraging conversion. But that is not the case before us, and therefore we're going to uphold this.
Yeah.
Well, it means he recognizes that there are lines that have to be drawn, which is ironic since the very reason he didn't want to use sectarian versus non-sectarian prayer as a standard before the court, is it would involve courts all across the country being involved in arguments about what was sectarian and what was non-sectarian prayer. A very strong point. One of the reasons that many of us had deep concerns about any kind of legislative prayer. So he's right on that. On the other hand, he recognizes that if you're not going to differentiate between sectarian and non-sectarian, then it could open up abuses that might require the court to get involved. So they're not going to avoid the line drawing one way or the other. I wish they had left it in the way it's been for the last 60 years in a much more limited ceremonial deism type approach that is far more inclusive and broader and encompassing America.
David, I think we both know that there are some majority religious groups that are celebrating the court's decision. Is this going to encourage the majority religions in the nation to further press for rights that result in the exclusion of some people who are a part in the public square?
You know, obviously it will. I mean, first of all, it sounds like there's no limit in the ability of a legislative body to simply pick and choose people on whatever criteria to give offer prayers on whatever criteria they want, which would include their religious identity, practices, or beliefs. That's deeply troubling to the government to be favoring one religion over another religion.
Mm-hmm.
That means that people who don't share those religious beliefs are going to be deeply troubled by this, to face a government that makes them feel like outsiders, which in the Sanjay O'Connor's endorsement test is exactly the criteria to be measured by and to be avoided. That no one by actions of the government on the basis of religious grounds should be made to feel like an outsider in America. And that is exactly what the court has threatened to make the norm in American life by allowing for almost no limits on the kind of prayer or the choices of legislatures of the kind of prayer that we will be hearing.
You said in the very beginning that the last three cases now that have been heard are showing this steady erosion of the separation of church and state. It's time for people who really believe that that is the way to maintain religious liberty to be worried and to be more active.
Absolutely. Yes, it is true. In the Salugard Czar case upholding the cross, in the Arizona tuition case that greatly limited the standing of people to contest government endorsement of religious practices and on the Establishment Clause grounds. And now this case, we've seen significant weakening, and we should be deeply concerned. And you said it exactly right, Welton, as you've said so eloquently over the years. And the fact is, it is the wall separating church and state that has kept government out of religion and allowed religion to flourish with a diversity and strength in America, unmatched anywhere in the democratic world, where there is government-endorsed religion, sponsored religion, established religion. And we have been the beneficiaries of that protection that the wall separating church and state has afforded us. For the small-time gains, this is really selling our birthright for a bowl of porridge. Mm. Whatever the gain is about having your prayer now allowed here and getting a certain amount of government money, whatever it is in tearing down this wall, in the end, we'll end up with a very different country with arguments between religious groups over whose prayers will now be heard and whose prayers won't be heard, who will get government endorsement and who won't, who will get government money and who won't. We're going down a very dangerous path. And, you know, there clearly seems to be a fifth vote on the court with Alito replacing Sanjay O'Connor about greatly expanding government funding of religious activities as well, at least money going to pervasively sectarian institutions like churches and parochial schools to the secular parts of their program. We're looking at a very different America than we've known for the last 60 years that's seen such an extraordinary growth in religious life. And I think those who are satisfied today about this decision will be deeply troubled by the long-term implications.
Rabbi David Saperstein is director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. He's a longtime board member of Interfaith Alliance. He is a dear friend of mine. David, thanks so much, as always, for being with us today. You enlighten us and you inspire us. Thanks
Take care,
for being
my friend.
With us. Muslim Advocates is an organization that works to guarantee freedom and justice for Americans of all faiths. This week, they released a comprehensive new report titled, Click Here to End Hate, anti-Muslim bigotry online, and how to take action. And I am really happy to welcome Muslim Advocate Staff Attorney Madiha Ahusain to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, Madiha.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Would you talk about how bad it can get?
Hate and bigotry towards American Muslims continues to be an issue. Particularly in the last few years, we've seen that post 9/11 backlash continues to remain a problem, and there are hate crimes targeting American Muslims, anti-Sharia legislation that continues to be proposed or passed in various states throughout the country. And it also trickles down into mosque opposition for construction sites or vandalism of mosques that already exist. The hate that we see in the broader society has also actually appeared on various platforms online. And that's part of why we thought it was important to take a look at that realm of hate and try to put out a resource for people who are dealing with that type of hate.
You were able to identify in this report some of the most influential sources of anti-Muslim propaganda. And I'd like for you, if you will, to tell us what some of those are.
As you mentioned in the report, we tried to cover some of the anti-Muslim proponents that have been able to gather a significant number of supporters in a very short period of time. There are some groups in the report that we talk about that have been identified by others, such as the Southern Poverty Law Center or the Anti-Defamation League, as hate groups that are targeting American Muslims. One example of that is Stop Islamization of America, who is led by Pamela Geller and her co-founder, Robert Spencer. They've been able to gather a significant number of supporters on their social media platforms. So if they have their own Facebook page, they can, you know, quickly spread their views and their opinions about Muslims instantaneously to a number of people that are following them online. And that's just one example. And the report is designed to be basically a resource, but, you know, it only covers a few examples. There are numerous examples of hate and hateful groups, hateful views that are being spread online within just seconds to hundreds of thousands of people or even millions of people.
Some of the statistics in this report are just staggering. For example, 49% of Americans believe Islam is incompatible with the American way of life. Do you see the online bigotry as the driving force behind that kind of statistic?
I think that the online bigotry helps to perpetuate that type of hate. What's interesting about the way that hate can spread quickly online is that it's almost in many ways permanent. People can go and find something that was posted from months ago or years ago online if the perpetuator or the proponent didn't take it down. It's instant and it can be permanent. And as you mentioned, sometimes people can type really hateful things online and they're not as concerned about the implications of that hate because there's less identity associated with that person. There's anonymity that they can sort of hide behind when they're speaking online. And that helps to amplify the voices and the messages that they're intending to put out there online.
Madiha, I know that it's almost impossible to read motivations and to incorporate that in polling data, but I can't understand what's driving people like Pam Geller. In your opinion, do they really believe that Islam is incompatible with America? Do they really believe the fear that they try to engender in others? Or is this about something else? And who's financing this?
I think it's really hard to say what their true motivations are. But we've seen that the broader society, the American public, have created sort of a space where it's acceptable to say what they're saying. It's acceptable for them to use their public platforms, whether it's online or offline in society, to be able to express their views of Islam and Muslims. And the fact that they have such a strong following just makes it that much more concerning for us that, you know, people are listening to them, people are hearing what they're saying, and it's on us to try to educate people and try to inform others that there are opinions about Islam that are not well-founded or that are misinformed.
Yeah.
As you may know, there's a significant amount of money that has been put towards these groups. They're well-funded organizations and people that have been able to gather a significant amount of support because of the space that they're given, both, you know, online and offline, to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And it's our goal to use a report like this and the other work that we and other organizations are doing, our allies like you guys and others, to try to inform those people that are just not sure, you know, just to try to educate them about what's really out there and what we're doing to try to combat and counter the anti-Muslim hate and bigotry towards religious minorities.
What's the greatest cause for concern when it comes to online hate and bigotry?
The greatest cause for concern is that whatever we're seeing online has real-life consequences for people in their daily lives. When someone experiences hate online that's actually threatening their safety or endangering their life, we're concerned about how that can affect people. There are spaces online that have been created where people can actually threaten violence or encourage violence towards people. Some of the examples that we included in the report are ones that really point to the concern about threatening violence with, for example, the How to Wink at a Muslim photograph that was posted on Facebook by a county commissioner in Coffee County, Tennessee, a man holding a shotgun, and the caption was How to Wink at a Muslim. And we're concerned about how public officials or public figures feel comfortable posting images like that online and just leaving it up to others to react to that. And others can take that to mean actually advocating for violence against American Muslims in their communities or anywhere in America. And we're very seriously concerned about what implications that have for people in their daily lives.
Maheda, are there cases where individuals have been targeted online for their Muslim faith and then implicitly viewers have been encouraged to take action against that person?
You know, in doing research for the report, we were only able to sort of provide a cursory overview of all the types of hate that are appearing online. But, you know, we have seen one of the examples in the report talks about a bullying of a student in high school. And we have seen that Facebook was where the students initially threatened violence against that student. And there was no action taken in response to that by school administrators or law enforcement. And she was later attacked physically. And then Facebook was then used again by the attacker to sort of brag about what happened. So I don't know if there's implicit or explicit threats that then lead to violence. But, you know, that's an example of how the social media platform was used in conjunction with the attacks that are physically taking place.
One of the superlative points about this report, and a reason that I love it like I do, is that you don't just chronicle the problems. You also offer some solutions. And I'd like for you to talk about what people who come across online religious bigotry can do about it.
There are two main responses that we focus on in the report. One of them is using the tools that social media platforms have designed to actually report offensive content. Many of the leading social media companies and internet companies have specifically designed these tools so that they can hear from their users. They're driven by user feedback, and they really look to us, the users, to tell them what we think is offensive, what we think is hateful, and they have policies specifically addressing hate speech. Mm-hmm. So in the report, you'll see that we talk about hate speech policies by Facebook and YouTube, and we also talk about the policy by Twitter that focuses on violence and threats.
Mm-hmm.
So we really encourage users to use those reporting functions and let the companies know what they're concerned about.
Right.
The second thing that we highlight in the report is counter speech and how effective and powerful it can be as an antidote to hate speech. And we give some specific examples of counter speech, one that occurred most recently with the announcement of Miss America 2014 when she won the crown, and how you can quickly transform a hate-fueled message into something productive and positive when you're using counter speech.
Mm-hmm.
And we really encourage people to use the social media platform as a way of, you know, educating others and maybe using humor or ridicule to sort of lighten the topic, but also send a message.
Yeah. If people go to your website, will they find there some recommendations for reading material that will help counter the lies and the prejudice that's being distributed by these other people?
Our website definitely has resources that we direct people to learn more about our work and mm-hmm. also some of the work that our allies are doing. Of course, if anyone has any questions or if they'd like to know more about what we do, we would love for them to reach out. www.muslimadvocates.org.
What about listeners who want to get their hands on this report? Click here to end hate.
There's an online version available on our website, and there's also a page specifically dedicated to the report that sort of talks about some of the resources that we have. And if they want a hard copy of the report, they can request that from us on the website.
I've been speaking with Madia Ahusain, staff attorney with Muslim Advocates, and a driving force behind this new release. The organization has just published. It's called Click Here to End Hate, Anti-Muslim Bigotry Online and How to Take Action. There are great recommendations on how to counter the stuff as well. Madia, thank you so much for the work that you did on this project, and also thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really unthinkable. Hundreds of schoolgirls roused from their beds, loaded into trucks, and imprisoned. The organization claiming responsibility, Boko Haram, violently opposes the education of girls and women in a self-serving and savage misinterpretation of Islamic teachings. According to Human Rights Watch, it's not the first time the group has kidnapped girls and women. The news has unfolded this week, telling us that more girls have been kidnapped. The sheer numbers have forced the world in these instances to sit up and take notice. Joining me now to talk about this crisis is the Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, Executive Pastor of the Concord Baptist Church of Christ in Brooklyn, New York. Reverend Jordan Simpson, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What did it do to you when you first heard this story?
I felt like a whole lot of other people probably felt. I felt paralyzed.
Yeah.
I felt shock. And I think it was a reaction to the sheer numbers of girls who were reported to be kidnapped. When I started looking into the story more, trying to understand for myself, how is this happening? How is someone kidnapping hundreds mm-hmm. of girls? And then I had an opportunity to learn a little bit more about what happened before those girls were kidnapped. And I had to stop and take stock myself.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself to be a citizen of this globe
mm-hmm.
and concerned about matters across the globe, particularly around children. And I was not aware at all about what was happening in this region in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And so I had to take a moment for myself.
Tell us what you know about these girls and what was happening and as this transpired.
Even before these girls were kidnapped, this group, Boko Haram, slaughtered children in the weeks and months before. Mm-hmm. They slaughtered boys and girls. They attacked educators and teachers. It is a reign of terror on their community.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard nothing about that in our mainstream media. And then when this, you know, huge number of girls meets this fate and the story begins making its way to social media, then you get a clearer picture that these girls were in school, that there was some understanding that maybe it might not have been safe to be in school, mm-hmm. but the authorities made the decision for these girls to be in school to take their exams, and I don't mm-hmm. know what exam it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then that school was set upon by the members of Boko Haram,
mm-hmm.
and they literally kidnapped these girls while they were studying for their exams.
As a faith leader and as an activist, what do you see as the role of each of us in this kind of crisis? I bet all of us over the last several days have at some time or another said, this is horrible. What can we do to help impact this?
First of all, we need to understand that we can do something. And it can be totally appropriate for your context. I am a pastor of a church, and so I did what was appropriate for my context. But I also tried to respond as a mother, mm-hmm. tried to respond as a member of my community. And so the first thing I did with all of those hats on is to talk to the people who were in my circle of influence. I wanted everyone to know that this was happening and that it was not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the response immediately was, well, why aren't we hearing about it on the news? You know, so I began pointing people to social media sites. You know, we don't have time to even, you know, go into why it is that these kinds of things are reported more and through social media than they are mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
But in trying to get more information about it, I kept turning people to Twitter and to Facebook, trying to help people to see we have something developing here. We don't want 20 years from now to be looking back at this and to see this as our Rwanda moment,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I began talking to people and saying, this is not okay.
What about with your congregation? I'm interested in what kind of interaction you've had with your congregation about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, in the same there. So, you know, in trying to help people to understand what has happened with these girls and families a world away is horrific. But we also know our young people, even in our own communities, experience trauma and difficulty in the same way. We want the same thing for those girls as we want for our own children. And so I began trying to personalize their story.
Mm-hmm.
I began to lift their names and to say, Mary is precious. She's significant and she matters to God.
Mm-hmm.
She is God's ultimate priority. She's first on his agenda, and she should be on ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pick up the phone, call, email our elected officials, our legislators. We're signing the petitions, you know, change.org, the White House petition, trying to get President Obama's attention, and all of the petitions that we wanted to put everything in people's hands.
Yes.
To give them some way of responding. And then one young woman in my church, an amazing young woman, organized what I think was the first rally, the first demonstration in this country. She organized this rally up at the Nigerian embassy,
mm-hmm.
and she did it through social media. She said, I cannot not do something. And I don't know that what I'm about to do is the right thing, mm-hmm. but I know that I cannot not do something.
Yeah.
This issue is not being reported in mass media, but I know it.
Yes.
These girls, their faces are before me, and I have to speak up and say this is not right.
Would you talk about the Bring Back mm-hmm. Our Girls campaign?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this really is trying to amplify the voices of the girls' families in Nigeria. It's not really our campaign or anyone else's campaign. Mm-hmm. This is people across the globe who have taken up this Twitter hashtag, Bring Back Our Girls, because the mothers and the fathers in Nigeria, that is what they have been crying for. They mm-hmm. want their daughters back. And so that term has taken on a life of its own, and how you see it is on Twitter. You see there are Tumblr sites, Facebook sites, and everyone is trying to amplify the voices of these parents who for weeks had been trying to get the attention of their own government.
Right.
And so if the world joins in with them to say, bring back our girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter to the world whether those girls are Christian, whether they are Muslim, whether they profess any faith.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is that they are precious children, that their families want them back, and that what has happened is not right.
You know, it looks like by the middle of this past week that the White House was fully alert to what was going on and the mobilizing of the State Department to help. It looks like that there's going to be help there. You've mentioned two or three times the fact that the story outside of social media has been underreported. Do you have a hunch why that's true? It's baffling.
You know, I think that we live in an era where a couple of things are happening. First of all, most people have such short attention spans.
Mm-hmm.
They want short, consumable, you know, short bites of story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to sustain their attention over time. And so we have mass media, and I'm sure, you know, there are lots of responsible ones out there, but with mass media outlets who then feed that hunger, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then it just becomes this sort of really crazy dynamic. We have media that is focused on entertainment and sports and scandal
mm-hmm.
and maybe slip in a story if there is enough of a demand, which I think this case in particular shows.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the major media outlets, they were stuck on Sterling and they're still stuck on Benghazi and they're stuck on those things.
Right.
But when average, everyday, normal people have been saying, wait a minute, what is happening with these girls?
Mm-hmm.
And they also began reading their own social media and the tweets that folks have been, you know, directing their way and bombarding on their Facebook pages to say, no, this is what we want to know, what is going on.
Right.
Then they sort of turn their attention to it. I think that that is the age that we are in, and it requires people who care about what's happening in the world to be very intentional
mm-hmm.
about how they consume and pursue information. This is an example of how you could miss an incredible opportunity to, as a person of faith, amplify the voices of these parents
yeah.
because our attention is turned elsewhere.
Also involved here is the fact that to deal with the situation that we're seeing means looking at the immediate, but also looking mm-hmm. forward, because mm-hmm. the great hope for women and girls in repressive mm-hmm. societies is education.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely what Boko Haram so violently opposes.
Absolutely.
Are you in touch with or working to promote the empowerment of women in African countries? Because that just has to come.
We're not directly involved in that now, although this experience certainly highlights the need for us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We are very much involved in promoting education for girls, but for children, mm-hmm. you know, in Brooklyn, and being very clear about what that means.
Mm-hmm.
It means not just sending them to classrooms. It means awakening in them the desire to question and to not accept this world as is, but to,
mm-hmm.
to awaken the desire to question and the hunger for knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and to understand that the most dangerous thing that you can do for a child is to ensure that that child can read, that
yes.
that child pursues an education, because then they will be asking questions about why is it that power insists that I be powerless.
Yeah.
That is what's happening in the experience of what these girls have had to live through and their families have had to live through. But it's also, that's what's happening in many places
mm-hmm.
on this globe. When people learn that there is a world beyond them and that it means something for them to be educated, it puts them in danger
right.
with the powers that be. And that's a real thing.
I've been speaking with the Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, Executive Pastor of the Concord Baptist Church of Christ in Brooklyn, New York. Along with many other faith leaders, she's working to raise awareness of the 230 schoolgirls held captive in Nigeria by extreme radicals. Dr. Jordan Simpson, it's been a pleasure to have you with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Before we go, a few more thoughts about that Supreme Court case. Taking note of the great rejoicing the Supreme Court's ruling on prayer evoked at scores of people and organizations this past week reminded me of the infamous line from the officer who, during the war in Vietnam, commented on the destruction of the village of My Lai, "We had to destroy the village in order to save it." Look, what is there to celebrate in the High Court's decision to allow legislative prayers to be spoken in all kinds of public meetings? The big loser in this judicial decision was prayer itself, its uniqueness and its authenticity. This most recent decision of the High Court, like many before it, has provided a win for conservative forces in our nation at the expense of a broadside, if not a compromise, of religion. Has anybody thought of the fact that prayer is a spiritual practice better defined theologically than politically or legally? The classic definition of prayer is personal communication with God. Communion with God takes place at a level in the soul, spirit, and mind of an individual that is untouchable by government, by educational institutions, or any other external force. A proper theological spiritual understanding of prayer leads to the conclusion that nothing, no other person or no institution, can either prevent a person from praying or force a person to pray. Public prayers are risky at best and always vulnerable to prostitution and manipulation. That's why in the scriptures of many religious traditions, like in Christianity, my tradition, public prayer is discouraged. Jesus found offensive prayers offered in public to call attention to the one praying rather than to the substance of the person's communion with God. Real prayer does not occur to impress or to instruct other people. Frankly, the recent Supreme Court ruling on prayer dealt a legal blow to the authenticity of the spiritual practice of prayer, and consequently, it is no more than a ruling on the legality of making social, political, and governmental statements in civic social sessions in order to be heard by those assembled rather than by God. The one form of public prayer that's distinct from other forms of public prayers is a prayer articulated in a house of worship as a contribution to worship, whether spoken aloud, spontaneously, by script, or a liturgical reading. My pastoral prayers, offered in public worship, are explicitly directed to God with my awareness that my overheard communion with God may provide help for others wanting to pray or assure people in need that others are praying for them or embraced by other worshipers who join my prayers and make them their prayers. Well, believe me, The kind of public prayers that attracted the ruling of the Supreme Court hardly qualify as such personal and spiritual acts of communion with God. Like most of you, I have listened to public prayers in school board meetings, city council gatherings, and legislative sessions at the state and federal levels of government. Most frequently, the words bearing the identification of prayer are far more statements of public opinion or imperatives for civic action than an individual's honest communion with God. I'm not surprised that non-religious people are now planning to petition civic bodies to allow them as well as religious leaders to offer prayers at the beginning of their public meetings. Given the Supreme Court's decision, that seems fair. The High Court made clear that its recent ruling does not protect public prayers that negate others' religions or convey incivility. In other words, the court affirmed the offering of prayers that meet the court's civil standards. Of course, I favor that part of the ruling. But honestly, I don't want the justices of the Supreme Court or anybody else in government trying to define what I can or cannot say in my private communion with God, and it's ridiculous to think that could occur. When will we learn? Every time we submit a sacred act to a civic body asking for a ruling on its appropriateness in a diverse public, we allow others who are not thinking theologically, to compromise the most sacred aspects of our religious practices. And in such situations, regardless of who wins in court, religion and its holy practices lose everywhere. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution. Today would be a really good day to do that. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week we hear from listeners all across the nation who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they simply can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews there, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can stay in touch with us all through the week, and we hope you will. Use Facebook and Twitter. The listener line, if you want to use that, is 202-681-4246. As always, we encourage you to tell other people about the show, encourage them to listen, and then join you for a conversation about the show. And let's expand the conversation all across our nation so that we're talking about matters that really are of importance to our whole way of life. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.